accession number 28361, reel 39.
General Julian Thompson, reel 39.
You worked a buddy system, and at halts you checked each other to see that you didn't got white edges of your ears, which would indicate they were starting to freeze, or your nose was freezing.
Is it the ears that are the first?
Well, they're the most exposed.
Yes.
And though you've got caps that will, with flaps on,
yes,
quite often when you're hot, you ski with just a summer cap, which is a sort of like, you know, the ski cap, traditional one, like a German army ski cap. But your ears can get cold and freeze without you realizing it, as can your nose. And then things like, you know, how to make certain you to prepare hot food, which is very necessary. Eating is very important. You get through something like 6,000 calories a day. In those sort of conditions.
Did people find it difficult to cram the calories in?
No.
They didn't?
No. People ate like, I don't know what. They practically ate the wrappings off the paper, off the food. No, one didn't find it difficult.
And the other thing, I think, is hot liquids are important.
Hot liquids are important because liquid is important.
Yes.
And drinking is very important. Drinking enough fluid is very important because of this business of dehydrating, which affects both your normal dehydration effects of feeling weak and also the effects of increased cold injuries from dehydration. It was quite interesting because while we were there, there was a team from the Naval School of Medicine doing a study into frostbite, dehydration, and cold injuries all together. I mean, wounds heal much slower in those conditions. Gangrene sets in much quicker because of the
damage to the tissue
and so on. So all those things are things you had to learn.
What about clothing and footwear, things like that?
Well, you had to learn the proper use of the clothing and footwear. And we used to have a thing called the ski march boot, which was meant to be able to be skied and marched in, because you occasionally had to walk in it, of course. Then you had snow gaiters and windproof trousers and tops and the correct use of all your kit. Thermal underwear and all the rest of it was taught.
Another risk, I think, in such conditions is snow blindness.
Yes. Well, you had goggles. You had tinted goggles, which were issued. And you're quite right. And it was a question of making certain people learn to get them on before it started affecting them.
Yes.
And then there was avalanche training. What to do if you got caught in an avalanche.
What should you do if you're caught in an avalanche?
Well, if you think you're going to get caught in one,
you shouldn't go out.
You shouldn't go there in the first place. Secondly, if you are caught in it, then you get rid of your pack if you can. You undo your ski bindings, but keep the skis on to try and ski out of it away to the side if you can, because that'll be the fastest way you'll go. But with your bindings on, and we had this Norwegian binding, it was rather like a Kandahar binding. Instead of going down there, it went along
the side of the foot.
The clip was on the side of the foot. But you can ski in just the toe straps with the bindings undone at a pinch. Get your take your poles off your wrists so that you don't go in with poles around your wrists, so you can let go of them. And then when you're in this wretched thing, and the whole thing absolutely fills me with horror, even the thought of it, try and swim upwards through the... Because when it sets like concrete.
With you in it.
With you in it. And then try and establish, when you are in it, which way up you are, so you don't waste time digging downwards, because you get disorientated. The old hand's answer is to have a pee. And if it dribbles up your leg, you know you're upside down.
Now, that's another thing. Isn't taking a leak in Arctic conditions?
No, I mean, it's not going to freeze that quickly.
You've got to be quick, though.
You've got to be quick. But one thing it tells you is if you're dehydrated.
Yes.
The colour tells you if you're dehydrated. Yes. what to do if you fall through the ice.
Wow.
And you practice it. And all the sort of survival techniques, how to build a shelter, if you haven't got a tent, how to build a... Mm. One of the things we had to do on the course was spend a night in a temporary shelter, which we built out of wood, out of bits of tree. Mm. How to put that up. You're actually doing in the Arctic what you're teaching chaps to do in the jungle, which is to be such masteries of your... of your environment, your fighting skills are not impaired.
Did you do climbing in Norway, ice climbing in particular? No. Was that part of the...
No, that wasn't. The people who did ice climbing are the mountain leaders.
Mm.
Because the Royal Marines run a two-tier mountain training. There's the mountain leader grade 2 and the ML1, which is the instructor grade, and they do a lot of ice climbing in Norway and in the Alps as well. But we didn't do any ice climbing. I mean, you were taught, because you were given crampons, what to do on ice, but not how to climb it.
Mm. What do you do on ice then? What is the...
Well, the trick with on ice is to use your crampons correctly and your ice axe. Mm. Mm. Correct, but we didn't do it. I mean, we didn't. We learned to ski on ice.
Yes.
And there was a question of using your edges, which are quite difficult on Norwegian military skis, because they don't have metal edges. So you skitter about all over the place.
They are effectively planks, aren't they?
They are planks. Yeah. They were known as NATO planks. We used to call them. And in fact, now I think that the British Army and the Royal Marines have plastic skis with proper edges. Mm. They've gone away from the wooden ski.
Mm.
At the time I did it, we had wooden skis. So you were taught all about ski waxing, for example, you know, what colour to use, blue, green, yellow, red.
That involves making a judgment about the snow, doesn't it?
That does, yes.
Which again is a skill.
Is a skill.
Interpreting the snow conditions.
Indeed, and what you relied upon at a company level, each company had a an ML1 in the company, who was a mountain leader 1, who was a highly trained climber, and he'd let his thermometer out and stick it in the snow, and so he'd just say, wax today, boys, is purple with blue underfoot, or red with green, green, or I can't remember, the fast wax is green, I think.
Mm.
And so the whole company would wax up with what the ML told them to put on. And eventually, after a while, you get a feel for what's right. Mm. You know what the temperature is. You've got it in your head, -5 means that kind of wax. -10 means that kind of wax. Mm. And that's the thing you can do to your friends, is to put the wrong wax on their skis.
Indeed. Yes.
So by the end of 3 weeks, people had got grounded in this technique, and then you did, as I say, you went on from there to collective training all the way up.
So you're building up.
You're building up. That's why it took 2.5 months.
Yes.
Because you had to allow time for people to do company. I mean, a CO would allocate so much time for his 3 week novice training, then there'd be company training, which would be section, troop, platoon, company. But then he'd end up with his own battalion or commando exercise, which he set himself, and then he'd take part in the brigade exercise at the end of the period.
And what did you do on the brigade exercise then?
The brigade exercise was taking part in a NATO exercise with the Norwegians.
On what scale was that? Was that divisional or
depended? I mean,
beyond?
It could be a division, a couple of divisions even.
on this first occasion.
The fun one, what I did, it was my brigade, Brigade North, 6th Division were commanding. I was under command of 6th Division. Brigade North was the enemy, and 6th Division had me and an American Marine Amphibious Brigade under command. So it was a three brigade exercise with 6th Division commanding two brigades, and the enemy commanded by somebody else, and then the overarching Com Non, I think, was commanding the whole damn shoot, the whole. I think it was Com Land Non, I think there was a Com Land Non in those days, was commanding the whole shooting match.
Where did that happen? Was that?
That happened. That brigade exercise was in the Lingen area.
So you were right up in the north.
We landed in the we embarked in the LPD.
Yes.
My brigade headquarters. Yes. They came round to Trondheim and we embarked, and then she sailed round, married up with the other ships, and then I had to land my brigade, which was two commandos strong, and hold up the advance of Brigade North, who were advancing up towards the Lingen Fjord.
Coming from the north?
They were coming from the south, actually.
They were coming from the south.
They were coming from the south. So it was sort of back to front, really.
Yes.
But they were coming the wrong way, effectively. Mm. And we were sort of backing away over 20 or 30 kilometres. We met them, and we had to delay them. Mm. And then there was an opportunity for them to advance on two axes. I had some Leopard tanks, Norwegian Leopard tanks, under command.
Now they must have serious limitations on their mobility.
Yes, they do. The Leopards. There was a squadron of Leopards. Mm. That's all.
I mean, the Norwegians always used to say that you need them for airfield defence, because any bit of flat ground is bound to have an airfield on it.
That's right. They were based at Bardufoss, and their task, as you say, was the defence of Bardufoss, the sort of Bardufoss airfield and its complex, the Bardufoss Valley, which you know is a pretty broad, typical Norwegian
glaciated
valley. So there is room to sort of get off the road on either side. And the Leopard was not bad across the snow, actually. You could get around.
Mm. Fairly broad tracks.
Fairly broad tracks. Yes. It was okay on flat-ish snow.
Yeah.
And I had number one squadron Royal Air Force in support.
What were they flying at that time?
Harriers. Oh. They came and supported us later. And that's the following year.
Yeah. I mean, did the Harrier do well in Arctic?
Oh yes, the Harriers, yes, because they were. The Harrier, the number one squadron, was part of the AMFL Air. The AMF, what was it? AMF brackets Air, I think it was. So they used to deploy. They were used to deploying to Turkey and Greece and Norway. Mm. They were very obviously deployable, because being Harriers, they were suitable for that. Mm. And the close air support was their métier, and they were jolly good at it.
Mm. And they didn't have any particular difficulty in snow conditions?
No. Mm. And we had helicopters and all the usual things, and we fought a delaying battle for about 5 days, I think.
How did the Norwegians perform in that?
Quite
fighting
well.
On the attack?
Quite well. They cheat like hell, of course.
Do they?
Yes. I mean, they take absolutely no notice of... I complained about it bitterly. They take no notice of things like artillery and mortar fire. I mean, you're not firing mortars and artillery.
But you're assuming.
So I would say, you know, how do these guys imagine they can ski out in the open across a piece of open, typical Norwegian valley when they've got a regimental fire mission cracking on around their ears? I mean, they're just not going to do it, I'm afraid. Sorry. This is bonkers. It's bad training. Yeah. And I think it was partly because, I think I just mentioned it before, because they only did a year's national service, their collective training was pretty poor. I mean, their ability to move across country was good, but their collective training was pretty poor on the whole.
Certainly lack of experience.
Lack of experience.
So they were imagining they could ski through an airburst bombardment.
Yeah, and the umpires weren't tough enough on them, saying, you know, you're taking 50% casualties, stop. Go a different way.
Also, it's rather unusual to have them on the attack, because their primary mission would be defence.
I think the reason was to give them something different to do.
Oh.
And they're... I mean, I can see why they want to do it. Their sort of pride as you know, the Brigade North was their sort of elite brigade, and their best COs were the COs in the Brigade North, and they were very proud of their ability to move across country fast, and they wanted to demonstrate that by big swinging, outflanking attacks. To which my answer was, I just put my OPs from my climbers up on the hills and just watch them doing it, and then hit them with artillery. I used to say to them, that's what will happen to you. Don't imagine, because you can't see us, we can't see you. so we used to have some quite lively discussions. But the main point, really, like all NATO exercises, was to give everyone a good run for their money and everyone to enjoy and everyone to think they've done terribly well.
Mm. Yeah. What were the American Brigade doing then at this time?
They were in defence, in a parallel valley to us, not doing terribly well.
The Norwegians tagging them as well, then?
Yeah. The best people among the Americans were one of their United States Marine Reserve units, who all were based in the East Coast somewhere, Maine or somewhere, where they used to ski a lot, and they were good skiers, and they were terrific, and they were all sort of doctors and lawyers and bank managers and things like that, having an enormous amount of fun in Norway for 3 weeks during their sort of TA camp. And they were totally different from your average sort of American Marine. They were highly intelligent and great fun.
So they were the sort of gentleman amateurs, amateur.
Yeah, they were there. They're the same as our TA.
They weren't retired Marines then? Who
some of them were. Some were, but most were the equivalent of the HAC or the Wessex Volunteers. I mean, they were TA equivalent, the nearest thing. But they were all... I mean, slight digression, the Americans do actually take their reserves rather more seriously than we do, I have to say. In that they have their jobs protected and all that sort of thing.
And they have good kit.
And these guys were good. Because they had this combination of being good at skis and also being able to think laterally.
Yeah. Well, it does seem to have been the case that during the Second World War, some of the best of the American divisions were actually National Guard.
Yes, yeah.
Partly because they had a wider age profile than the conscript divisions.
Yeah.
And they had a much broader occupational background than the professionals.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that they had a number of qualities that were...
Yeah, well, these guys had just that. They were the best. I had a Dutch battalion under command. That was the other. I had three units. I had a Dutch battalion under command.
And how did they do? Were they Marine? Were they Army then?
Yeah, they were Dutch Marines. Who were under my command, and who I think I may have told you, the Dutch Marines sort of joined with the Royal Marines in the 1970s.
Yes.
1971 or 1972. They used to give all their orders in English, even if there weren't any Englishmen there. Mm. And all their radio messages were in English. Mm. And they were really quite good. Mm. The interesting thing about it was that they have a union. And the CO of the Dutch battalion came to me very early on in the training, the 2.5 month training period, and said, the union rules are that if we're away from Holland for more than a month or 6 weeks or whatever it was, I can't remember the period, everybody has got to be given a week's leave home. Mm. So I said, well, that's going to face, how are you going to play that? Are you going to send the whole lot on leave? Or are you going to trickle them back? Or what? And... don't you think it's rather wasteful of money that your government spent on sending you here to then send people home? He said, yes, I do. I don't want to do it. So I said, would it help you if I, as the nasty Brit, ordered you not to do it and was totally unreasonable about letting you send your men, however much you argue? And he said, yes, you were. I said, well, then don't send them. I order you not to. There's never a problem.
Now, in the Netherlands, there is a very ancient tradition of skating.
Hmm.
But how did they get on with the skiing?
All right. okay. I mean, as well as the Brits did. I mean, you know, we are no more a sort of skiing nation than the Dutch are, really. In fact, the Dutch probably have better access to ski resorts than we do by getting into their cars and driving off to, to wherever.
The Alps. Yeah.
The Alps. Mm. So there was no problem about that. Mm. No, they were all right. Mm.
Did the Norwegian Air Force take part in this?
Yes, I can't remember. I think they were playing the enemy, I think. Yes, they took part. Mm.
Did anyone try and simulate Soviet tactics, or was it all being fought according to...
Not really. Mm. I mean, the Brigade North was certainly not simulating Soviet tactics. Mm. And there certainly wasn't... You didn't have... They didn't do any sort of day-end operations. They didn't have, you know, loads of helicopters dropping in behind us, parachutes or whatever. They didn't have armour, APCs, so and massive artillery they didn't have either. So really, no one was actually playing Soviet tactics.
It wasn't being done realistically.
No,
sense.
No. Yeah.
And what about the naval side of it? Did the Norwegian Navy have a role?
Yes. I mean, I didn't remember exactly what part that was, because as far as I was concerned, once I got off the ships, I didn't really care what they did. But the Norwegian Navy is very much a defensive navy. And, of course, the Norwegian Navy in those days used to provide their coast artillery, which now, of course, it doesn't exist anymore. And they provide what they call their Jäger, which are sort of commandos. Mm. So I don't know what part the Norwegian Navy played in this exercise. There was no doubt naval play on this exercise, I'm sure, but I don't remember what it was.
Presumably that would have been out to sea.
Yeah, I mean, there was the passage from Trondheim to the Lyngenfjord, and I'm sure the ships played what I call boats in the bath on the way up. Mm. But what form that took, I have no idea.
Mm. So that was your first...
Brigade exercise.
Business,
yeah.
Yes. Did you take the whole plan as it's been fixed and go with it, or did you introduce any adaptations?
No, I went with it. I went with it completely. And even the plan, the landing plan for the exercise, had been fixed before I took over, because in the way of all NATO things, it had been sort of massaged and put together weeks in advance and agreed with everyone who was going to take part in the exercise, so that all the other players' bits slotted into it.
It was a consensus plan.
It was very much how the NATO exercise planning system worked, as I had remembered it from the days when I was brigade major, where you went months and sometimes years before the exercise to some conference in Naples or Oslo or wherever, and got together all the other people who would take part in the exercise, who all had their own agendas of things they wanted to practice, which all had to be fitted in. Which is why the whole thing tended to be what I call a military minuet, in that everyone had their own parts to play in this dance.
Mm. What happened when you got back? You got back
when we got back, it was by then April, I suppose. Mm. And the next thing was my own brigade exercise on the Salisbury Plain, which was very much my exercise, which I designed and wrote and everything. And that exercise, I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was in the summer. And I had a lot of enemy for that exercise. I had one of my own commandos, 40 Commando, who'd just been in Northern Ireland. That's why they'd just come back from Northern Ireland. I had the whole of 3 Para with Hugh Pike, who'd been a student of mine at Camberley, now CEO of 3 Para. and I had on my own, on my friend, you know, on the friendly side, I had the Dutch and 4-2 commander, because 4-5 commander were in Northern Ireland. Mm. So I had sort of two units on each side playing against each other, and I had a squadron of armour as enemy on the other side as well, and a squadron of a recce regiment on my side. And I planned it as a withdrawal, because that's what we were probably going to have to do, all the way really from Imber Village all the way back to Sidbury Hill. Mm. Well, you know that area probably quite well, including back across the Avon. And I built in a number of things into it to make it more fun. For example, I had a Hugh Pike do a typical Soviet deep penetration drop.
He was like a descent then.
Descent onto my bridge that I had to have to withdraw over. So he dropped two companies and secured the bridge over which I was trying to withdraw. So I had the whole brigade sort of stacked up trying to get back. So we had to capture the bridge which had been destroyed as we tried to capture it. Which meant, and that was designed, which meant that my sappers had to build a bridge so that we could. Do you want to? My sappers had to build a medium girder bridge over the River Avon, over which I could withdraw. And I had lots of what I call wonderful cock-up factors built into the exercise to make life difficult. I had the Hugh also then dropped a company on my logistic area.
Is that his initiative or your initiative?
No, I asked him to do it. Mm. He dropped a company on so close to my logistic area, it was right by where all my helicopters were parked. And seeing them running to their cockpits and taking off in a panic, some of them forgetting to take off the gust locks on their tail rotors before they left, was quite a sight. So,
how did they respond generally? Did it sharpen people up?
Yes. I mean, I remember one CO, who I'm glad I didn't take the Falklands, who had been ordered by me to recapture this bridge behind us. By helicopter airborne, by heliborne assault, we're not land right on it, but land near it and retake it with his whole commando. And I had part of my brigade air squadron doing the part of Russian armed helicopters, and shooting down in quotation marks some of his helicopters. So they would follow one of his helicopters and come up in there and say, "We are behind you. We shot you down. Land the helicopter." And you're out of the battle, plus all the guys in it. Mm. And he arrived with only half his commando, wringing his hands. He said, "Well, no." Well, I said, "Hard luck. Aren't you lucky you got a half? That's what you'll have in reality. Now go and capture the bridge." Which he did. And right at the end, I threw one in, which was enormous fun, was his same unit was overrun by a commando and a squadron of armour, and I killed him and wiped out his whole commando headquarters, then broke into his own commando net, spoke to one of his company commanders. At that stage they thought the exercise was over, you see.
Oh.
And said, "Mount a counterattack and retake your commando headquarters. You are now the CO." He didn't know it was going to happen. And it was brilliant. He did it well, too. And he then got an MC a year later in the Falklands, commanding a company. But, I mean, he was a good chap. I think it was a good exercise from that point of view. There were lots of unexpected things chucked in to make people think.
Is it a common criticism of military exercises that quite often they do not include the unexpected, and in particular, they do not understand. They do not include things going catastrophically wrong at various levels. And,
well, that's what I tried to introduce was things happening that weren't
pre-planned.
So people sort of bimbling back, withdrawing, thinking, "Oh, we'll be back over the Avon by breakfast," and then we'll bring up. Suddenly, seeing 300 parachutists descending and capturing the bridge, and then they're rather feeble attempts at capturing it to begin with, being umpired out, so that a proper attempt had to be made, and then the thing's blown up. So the sappers then have to bring forward a medium girder bridge and build it. Until they've built it, you can't cross the Avon. Meanwhile, you're being pressed at the other end. And then you have to put a demolition guard on to guard your withdrawal routes, and then blow it when you're across. So you can build in all sorts of things into your the exercise.
What actually gave you the inspiration for designing these particular incidents or occurrences? Was it examples from history, or was it simply your own imagination of the worst thing that could happen in the given circumstances in the exercise?
But I think it's a combination of all those, and also the knowledge of that's how the Russians would try and sort you out. I mean, they'd try and capture bridges that they needed for themselves, or capture them in order to deny them to you, to bottle you up and so they cut you up and carve you to pieces. and they would use days out, you know, airborne operations to do that, and I had a parachute battalion to do it. So you know, let's use them. They were thrilled to be able to do that, and to be able to sort of do in the cabbage hats, as they call it. And Hugh played it brilliantly, and I think it was good value to do that. And the aim was to try, and we were trying to...